The controversial law, also known as AFSPA, was first enacted in 1958 to allow deployment of armed forces to counter a secessionist movement in the hills of Nagaland. 6 decades later, it is in force in Manipur, Assam, parts of Arunachal Pradesh, and in the Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir, the places labeled as disturbed areas. The legislation gives license to Indian Army soldiers to carry out excesses without fear of legal prosecution, even when they kill and injure people, raid houses without warrant, or use deadly and indiscriminate force on mere suspicion, like the case of Nagaland killings. The law has long shielded Indian soldiers stationed in the so-called disturbed areas from accountability for grave human rights abuses and has denied justice to the affected families. A 2019 report on Jammu and Kashmir by the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said the law remains a key obstacle to accountability. Following the latest incident in Nagaland, which has shaken the conscience of the nation of 1.3 billion people, calls for repealing the law have grown louder in all northeastern states. But will the BJP government in New Delhi move to abolish it? No one is quite ready to bet on that.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Kalol Bhattacharjee, Senior Assistant Editor with the Hindu newspaper. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Bhattacharjee. Let's begin with the recent civilian killings in northeast India's Nagaland state, which have reignited the long-running debate about the use and abuse of the Armed Forces Special Powers Act. Now, can you tell us what exactly happened in Nagaland?
Hello, thank you so much for inviting me to this bulletin and this discussion on the developments regarding AFSPA or AFSPA, as we call it in India. What happened that evening in Nagaland is that a group of daily wage workers were returning home from their work in a nearby mine. And while they were returning, they were ambushed by a group of Indian soldiers who also were reportedly working on solid intelligence inputs that a group of insurgents were waiting to carry out an attack on the Indian soldiers. So the report that came later on to us is that these soldiers were targeted by these were to be targeted by these reported insurgents, and therefore this ambush was carried out in a defensive way, so that insurgents could be neutralized. Howsoever, later on we heard that the issue was of mistaken identity, as it was claimed by the Indian Home Minister in the Parliament, and that the soldiers felt that they were going to be ambushed by a group of insurgents, and therefore they acted in self-defense. But very soon we got to know that the local villagers were the first to arrive at the scene, and they discovered that the bodies of those people who had been shot dead were being loaded onto a jeep or some other vehicles that the army soldiers were driving around in. So the local villagers came, and then they attacked the Indian soldiers, and which really led to a massive mayhem at that point. And that was the main reason that an Indian soldier also lost his life. It was, in brief, the entire sequence of events.
So, Mr. Bhattacharjee, this much-abused law grants the Indian Army unbridled powers to maintain public order in so-called disturbed areas. Now, do you think this is a smokescreen to escape accountability for human rights abuses?
I would also like to mention that this particular area of Nagaland is very close to the international border with Myanmar. And also please remember that the crisis in Myanmar has been escalating over the last 8 months or so. And the international community has not really acted in a collective manner to ensure any sort of pressure on the Myanmar's junta. What's happening as a result is that there is a spillover effect on the nearby areas, especially on India's northeastern areas, where a lot of the smuggling activities have heightened, because the Myanmar rulers themselves are involved in drugs and other sorts of smuggling activities. And what's of great concern is that apart from the exodus of people from Myanmar, There is also this, you know, influx of these goods and items and drugs into India's border areas and also into Bangladesh. So this has also heightened tension among the heightened tension as well as distrust among the armed forces or the law enforcement agencies, as well as the locals and those people who are involved in those sort of activities, illicit activities. So this basically, in the context of this particular development in India's neighboring Myanmar, what's happening is that this kind of a law, that is a law like AFSPA, has more chances of getting abused, because if there is no faulty information or intelligence about a certain movement of drugs or movement of insurgents, then this sort of laws actually increase the chances of such incidents being repeated in future as well.
Like you've mentioned, there have been numerous protests in northeastern Indian states as well as in Jammu and Kashmir against this law over the years. Now, how do Indian authorities justify its continued use?
Well, as you understand, the situation in Kashmir has been problematic for a very long time because of India's position as well as because of Pakistan's perceived interference. What happens in Kashmir is that the law and order situation on the ground is always very fragile because of cross-border attempts from the Pakistani side to keep the pot boiling in Kashmir. And on the ground level, you have a big presence of the ultras or the other, insurgents from the other side are always present in some numbers. So that is one issue which the Indian state has often cited as one of the main reasons why it has kept AFSPA in Kashmir. And that is often the only answer that we have received from the Indian state whenever the extra-legal developments have taken place in Kashmir. Having said that, I must say that that is not the only legal instrument in the hands of the Indian state as far as Kashmir is concerned, because the region is highly militarized. And in that context, not a very normal governance process can't really function, and therefore the Kashmiri situation is very unique, and the Indian state has often cited that as one of the main reasons that has enabled its use of AFSPA on the ground in Kashmir.
Before we let you go, sir, one last question. Why has there been no international outcry over the Indian government's use of the controversial law?
Well, there has not been any international outcry on the AFSPA, primarily because India prides itself on its democratic credentials. But also, please remember that after this particular incident took place in Nagaland, whether we call it an outcry or not, the issue of AFSPA or the abuse of such extra-legal matters laws by the enforcement agencies or the Indian Armed Forces has been taken up by the UN Human Rights Council.
Mr. Bhattacharjee, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Senior Indian journalist Supriya Sharma says the families of civilians killed by the Indian Army in Nagaland have refused government compensation until the culprits are punished and the controversial law is repealed. Conrad Sangma, the Chief Minister of northeastern Indian state of Meghalaya, extends his support to protesters in Nagaland in their demand to have AFSPA repealed from the northeast. A legislator from northwestern Gujarat state, Jignesh Mavani, says the Nagaland killings should force authorities to rethink and review the draconian law so that accountability can be fixed.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
The centuries-old central mosque in the summer capital of Indian-controlled Kashmir has remained largely locked for the past 2 years since the abrogation of the region's special status sparked unrest. Built in the 15th century, the mosque is seen by Indian authorities as a trouble spot. It's a place where Kashmiri Muslims gather to offer Friday prayers and to raise voice for their legitimate political aspirations. They see its closure as denial of the right to religious freedom.
The closure of the Himalayan region's 600-year-old central mosque known as Jamia Masjid and denial of permission to Kashmiri Muslims to hold the congressional Friday prayers for the past 2 years has deepened anger and resentment among them. The mosque was shut down immediately after the Narendra Modi-led BJP government in New Delhi stripped Indian-controlled Kashmir of its semi-autonomous status. In the past 2 years, which have been marked by intermittent protests and shutdowns, the historic mosque has remained out of bounds to worshippers on Fridays, even though authorities allow it to remain open on other days. Jamia Masjid has played a key role in the region's turbulent history. It has traditionally been the bastion of resistance against Kashmir's autocratic rulers. In 1819, Sikh rulers had closed it for 21 years. During the rule of Dogra Hindu dynasty between 1846 and 1947, the mosque often remained shut. In the past 30 years, since the anti-India resistance gained momentum in Kashmir, Jamia Masjid has been subject to periodic bans and lockdowns by successive Indian governments. The chief priest of the mosque and senior pro-freedom leader, Mirwaz Umar Farooq, has often delivered fiery political speeches from the mosque's pulpit, highlighting the political struggle of Kashmiris. Interestingly, in the year 1980, during his visit to Kashmir, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had also delivered a historic sermon at the mosque, which focused on Shia-Sunni unity.
While the Indian government, as part of sweeping measures to crush political dissent, has imposed a tougher security clampdown in Indian-controlled Kashmir since October 2019, infringement of religious freedom has been a long-lasting phenomenon in the disputed region. Besides closing mosques and putting religious leaders and clerics under house arrest, there is a long-running ban on the historic Muharram temple session in Srinagar city, which Kashmiri Muslims see as a blatant breach of their religious freedom.
Muharram processions in Kashmir date back to the early 16th century, when both Shia and Sunni Muslims would come together to parade the streets on the day of Ashura. The processions were banned during the rule of Afghans, followed by Mughals, Sikhs and Dogras, who had a hostile attitude towards Shias. However, in the latter part of the Dogra rule in the late 19th century, the tradition was revived with the cooperation of both the communities. In 1989, when armed resistance against the Indian rule began in Kashmir, the government of India moved swiftly to impose a ban on the procession as part of sweeping measures to deal with the political unrest. Almost 33 years later, the ban remains in place. Each year, police impose curfew-like restrictions on Muharram 8th and 10th in the heart of Srinagar city to foil the Muharram processions. And each year, thousands of mourners defy the ban and carry out peaceful processions while being subjected to brutal police action. Mourners are intercepted by heavily armed police and paramilitary personnel who fire tear smoke canisters and resort to baton charge. Last year, dozens of them were arrested who spent months in jail. Despite repeated pleas, the successive Indian governments have refused to lift the illegal ban.
Now, to have more insight, I would like to welcome Mr. Zamir Ahmed Awan to the program. He is an ex-diplomat and political analyst. Mr. Awan, the centuries-old Grand Mosque of Kashmir has remained closed for the past 2 years. Why is the historic mosque seen as a trouble spot by Indian authorities?
Thank you very much for inviting me to give my comments. In fact, it is a symbolic mosque. It belongs to the Islamic history and represents the Muslim community in the Kashmir. Historically, India was ruled by the Muslim for almost 800 years, and there was a complete harmony between the Muslims and the other religions in India under the Islamic rule. Since the India got independence in 1947, for almost seven decades, Muslims and other minorities in India were living almost peacefully. But since the BJP government took power under the leadership of Narendra Modi, the extremist wings like RSS are promoting hate against the minorities, especially against the Muslims. And they have an agenda to purify the India as a pure Indian state without any other religion. So they are also harming other religion in addition to the Muslims, like Christians, Sikhs, and Buddhists, and all other religion. Especially in the Kashmir, where the Muslims are in the majority, they are more harming the Muslims, and this mosque has historical importance. That's why they have closed for the almost couple of years.
Mr. Awan, the Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi has taken many controversial measures since October 2019. Now, do you see the closure of the mosque as part of a plan to deny Kashmiris their religious freedom?
You are absolutely right. Since 2019, Narendra Modi, when won the election, his slogan was to convert the India into a pure Hindu state. And he has got the support from all the extremist Hindu groups like RSS. And as per his agenda, as per his promise in the election, he have to take severe and extremist measures against the minorities, not only against the Muslim but also against the Christian and other religions also, like amended citizen act, cancelling the constitution and occupying the occupied Kashmir, and also many other measures which are extremist. And that is a part of their political plan, and they might do something more harmful to the Muslims.
So for Muslims in Kashmir, the mosque closure also brings painful memories from the past. Why has this mosque always been at the center of political storm?
Always the center point for the political activities in Kashmir. The Muslim freedom movement in Kashmir is always having meetings there and gathering there, and a lot of protest against the Indian government was originated from this mosque. And in past also the Indian security forces has sealed it and closed it for many times, but recently they have taken very prolonged action to close down this mosque. I think it is politically motivated and ill-planned.
Mr. Awan, the Indian government has also not allowed the historic Muharram procession to take place in the Srinagar city for the past 3 decades. Now, why is it afraid of peaceful religious practices of Kashmiri Muslims?
In fact, the Indian government is suppressing the Muslims and not allowing them to perform their religious duties. The procession of Muharram is a ritual and has been performing for many centuries peacefully, but Indian government is afraid when the Muslims are gathered, they might protest against the government, or they might make some slogans against the government. So in preventing such a situation, they have not allowed the Muharram procession for several years. In fact, not only the Muharram procession, but also other religious activities also are banned.
Mr. Awan, while Muslims are barred from exercising their right to religious freedom, Hindus are allowed to perform their religious rites, even publicly. Now, do these double standards point to something deeply sinister?
In India, there are many other religions and minorities. The dominating is the Brahman, which are only 8% of the whole population, but they are in power, they are in the government, they are in the bureaucracy, they are in the security forces, they are in the police, they are in the district management, and they are controlling all these things, and they are suppressing the Muslims, especially in the Kashmir, where Muslims are in the majority.
Mr. Awan, thank you for being on the program. Love to talk to you again. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Zubair Amin, a Kashmir-based independent journalist, notes that Kashmiri Muslims have long accused New Delhi of curbing their religious freedom on the pretext of law and order, while promoting and patronizing the annual Hindu pilgrimage. Multimedia journalist from Kashmir, Mukhtar Zahur, pictures a man who traveled 40 kilometers to offer Friday prayers at Kashmir's central mosque, only to realize that it has been shut. Masroor Ansari, a senior Kashmiri pro-freedom leader, slams the Kashmir police for brutal use of force to thwart a peaceful Muharram procession in Srinagar recently.
And that was our episode about the growing calls in India for the repeal of a controversial law in the wake of the recent civilian killings in Nagaland state and also the denial of religious freedom to Kashmiri Muslims by the Indian government. Take care.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, development and growth of religious community. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's topic, we will talk about the topic of development and growth of the religious community in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic texts, we see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has emphasized on the marriage and through legal ways of the marriages. And the development and growth of the religious community can be obviously gained through the marriages, through having more kids, through having a big community, and this big community or number of people can have a better development and the growth of religious community. Therefore, when we look at the narrations of the Prophet, we see that the Prophet has said that مَا بُنِيَ بِنَاءٌ فِي الْإِسْلَامِ أَحَبُّ إِلَى اللَّهِ تَعَالَى مِنَ التَّزْوِيجِ, that there is no foundation in the Islam which is better than or which is more loving near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, near God, and that is the tazweej, and that is marriage. Why marriage is being given so much importance is because the marriage is a bond between a male and female, a legal bond by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and through this the generations are generated, the next generations will continue because of these bounds, these legal bounds. And when there is a legal bound, obviously we will have pure generations. And why? Because this legal bound is a pure bound and it results in the pure generations, not impure generations. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of development and growth of religious community. And one of the main important aspects is that this community should grow on the basis of purification. And the purification in the society comes with the legal bounds. It comes with the legal marriages and not adultery or something which has become a trend, especially in the Western community. And also it is having its effects on the Eastern world as well, which is the relationship between a boy and a girl without having a marriage, which they call being a boyfriend or girlfriend. This is not legal according to Islam. And we can see that in the Western societies, there are many kids who are the results of this friendship, which was between a male and female, a boy and a girl. And maybe they were together for 3 months, 6 months, or maximum 1 year, and then they basically had finished their relationship, but this relationship resulted in having some kids or a kid. And obviously, this is not legal according to Islam. Islam talks about the responsibility. Islam says you cannot just have kids without having any responsibility, like not taking the responsibility of the kid. Therefore, Islam says that between male and female, if there is a relation, if they want to have friendship, that is the marriage. And through this marriage, obviously, they cannot go away from what they have done. And this marriage, which is a pure relation between the man and woman, and they become husband and wife, it results in pure generations, the children who are pure, and these generations can lead the nations in the pure way, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
As coal power is phased out in favour of cheaper renewable energy, the fossil fuel's future looks bleak. Yet coal is making a comeback as it helps power post-pandemic recoveries. Amid a worldwide energy crisis, global coal power emissions are surging to pre-pandemic highs, especially in China and India. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Deutsche Welle journalist Stuart Braun, Ruby Russell, and Jennifer Collins. Coal power is phased out in favour of cheaper renewable energy, the fossil fuel's future looks bleak. Yet coal is making a comeback as it helps power post-pandemic recoveries. Amid a worldwide energy crisis, global coal power emissions are surging to pre-pandemic highs, especially in China and India. Rising oil and gas prices and the onset of winter have conspired with the energy needs of rebounding post-COVID-19 economies to increase coal demand after a long decline. The renaissance of the most carbon-intensive fossil fuel was further reinforced when a commitment to a coal phase-out in the Glasgow Climate Pact was weakened to a phase-down. Going into COP26, the UK president of the conference, Alok Sharma, said he hoped the summit would consign coal power to history in a bid to keep global warming to around 1.5 degrees Celsius rise. That didn't quite happen, though. A green light for more coal production was how former Australian Resource Minister Matt Canavan responded to the last-minute diluting of the plan to exit coal. The countries in our region, like India, like China, like Southeast Asia, are growing and developing their industries, and their demand for coal almost has no limit, he said in a television interview. Experts admit that the weakened language in the Glasgow Agreement could muddy the broader momentum towards a coal phase-out by 2030 or 2040 at the latest. But the current spike in coal demand will be short-term phenomena linked to a strong post-lockdown economic rebound, believes Katharina Hillenbrand von der Neyen, head of the research at climate think tank Carbon Tracker. I would strongly caution against any view that this is the revival of coal. Von der Neyen expects coal to revert to its pre-COVID slide driven by cheaper renewable energy, including in China, which generated over half of the world's coal-fired power in 2020. The structural trend is for steeply falling load factors, she said, meaning that with the competition from renewable energy, coal plants aren't running at full capacity, rendering them unprofitable. While new coal power plants are being built, they contribute to an oversupply that only exacerbates the problem. As a result, 27% of the global coal fleet has become unviable, according to Carbon Tracker. If I could put all my eggs into the coal basket again, you might find they drop onto the floor quite quickly, said Katharina Hillenbrand von der Neyen of coal's precipitous long-term outlook. Gaurav Ganti, a researcher with Berlin-based think tank Climate Analytics, agrees. This short-lived renaissance is unlikely to persist, given strong headwinds from low-cost renewable energy, he said. Even as China and India power their COVID recovery with coal, the fact remains that the number of planned new coal power plants has declined by 76% since 2015, when the Paris Climate Accord was signed, according to the climate change think tank E3G. This is equivalent to China's whole coal capacity. China provided about 75% of global coal investment in 2020. However, its decision in September of this year to end funding of coal projects beyond its shores and to peak its own coal use by 2025 as part of its 2060 net zero emissions plan is a further signal of coal's inevitable demise, said Gaurav Ganti. However, there is no room for complacency, he added. Even despite the broader commitment by 47 countries at COP26 summit to phase out coal via the Global Coal to Clean Power Transition Statement, our work indicates that keeping to 1.5 degrees Celsius rise, the warming limit of the Paris Climate Accord, requires coal-fired power to be phased out by 2030 in developed economies and by 2040 globally. Developing countries will require substantial international support for ditching coal. And despite the Glasgow conference backing away from the firm language on ending coal, individual countries are bringing their phase-out deadlines forward. Germany's new governing coalition, comprising of Social Democrats, SDP, Greens and the Free Democrats, the FDP, is aiming for a 2030 coal exit, 8 years ahead of the country's previous schedule. Germany is Europe's second largest coal consumer and producer, but even amid a nuclear energy phase-out, it already managed to halve coal power consumption between 2010 and 2020. And while it's true that coal energy demand has also spiked in Germany in 2021, this was due in part to unusually poor weather conditions for wind and solar power. Along with other European Union nations and the United States, Germany is also helping to finance a coal phase-out in South Africa, which produces 90% of its energy from coal and is the biggest emitter of the fossil fuel in Africa. Germany's then Environment Minister described the $8.5 billion initiative agreed to in the Glasgow summit to fund the shift from coal to clean energy as a potential blueprint for other regions of the world. Meanwhile, Portugal this week completely stopped burning coal for energy, 2 years ahead of a planned phase-out. Fossil fuel powerhouse Ukraine has also committed to ending coal power generation by 2035, or by 2040 at the latest. At the COP26 summit, the country joined the Powering Past Coal Alliance, a coalition of national governments, businesses and organizations committed to an accelerated coal exit. Researchers are warning that governments who stick with coal could be set to lose billions in stranded assets, as well as hundreds of thousands of jobs, as the world decarbonizes to limit heating to below 2 degrees Celsius. A stranded asset is something that had value or generated income but no longer does. According to a June 2021 report, one-third of coal mines in Europe, North America and Australia will become stranded assets by 2040 if countries meet their climate targets. Australia, for example, could lose $25 billion per year in this scenario. Globally, 2.2 million jobs could be at risk unless countries act quickly to transition to a cleaner energy system. But economics is not the only motivation to get out of coal. Governments face a choice here, said Gaurav Ganti. Invest in fossil fuels of yesterday and risk stranded assets, or invest in renewable energy to get us to a 1.5 degrees Celsius rise pathway.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing In this program we discuss problems, issues and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are mostly based upon the holy book of the Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and naturally of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend, an Islamic researcher, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Continuing our discussion from the previous session of how we should raise our children in a non-violent manner, we spoke about a few topics, a few pointers. We said, for example, that we should encourage good behavior in our children by enforcing it, by appreciating their actions if it's a good deed, and on the flip side, also by discouraging bad behavior. And in addition to that, we also said that sometimes you should let your children experience the consequences of their actions. You shouldn't immediately step into the situation and punish them. No, let the course of action takes its pace, and then the child himself will learn a valuable lesson. Dear Sayyid, what else must we keep in mind when we are raising our children in a non-violent manner?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه Another way to prevent violence with kids is the fact that you have to explain to them the results of certain actions So if you give them and teach them properly in a manner they can understand that the consequences of such an action will be like this, then that should at least most of the times, or at least some of the times, will help the child not do whatever they're planning to do.
So for example, explain the consequences is what you're saying.
Yeah, so for example, you tell them, look, if you do not organize and pick up your toys, you'll lose them, like you won't be able to play with them, we'll take them
away. You won't be able to find
for about 3 days, 4 days.
Right.
And like you take them, like you tell them the consequence.
Okay.
If you don't do this, you'll, for example, be taken away from you for 3 days.
Right.
If you don't clean your room, this will happen. If you don't do that, this will happen. Right. So it's kind of, you know how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran says, if you, for example, those who eat the wealth of the orphans, they fires in their stomach, those
right.
who does this.
Yeah.
So this is just preventive measures.
Right.
So I know about them, I take them into consideration, my relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is still, as we say, peachy,
yes.
and it's lovey-dovey.
Right.
But at the same time, I know that I should not cross certain limits.
Even though we do cross certain limits, knowing
that it's haram, we still cross it.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, we do understand the consequences. That
right.
if anything happens, for example, the ayah that always scares me the most, Whatever problems, whatever calamity falls onto you is because of your own hand. So next time something happens, I'm like, oh, it's my fault.
Yeah, and with that sobering thought, we will go on a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how we should raise our children in a non-violent manner. Dear Sayyid, please pick up where you left off.
So we said we have to explain to them the consequences of certain actions that they do.
Right.
and as long as the child knows what happens.
Yeah.
Also, depriving them of some of the pleasantries that
right.
the children indulge themselves in. For example, TV or playtime.
Right.
Or, for example, if you don't do your homework on time, for example, you know, you would lose this. But if you do it on time,
right.
or before time, we'll let you do this.
So you were indirectly threatening them with the sanctions.
Well, kind of sanctions.
Right.
So it's a sort of, I mean, funny you mentioned sanctions because the whole world is scared of America because of sanctions, so they do whatever America wants.
Yeah.
So pretty much, we're not saying be a bully like America and try to scare the whole world, but in a sense, same thing that, you know, because we do love things and we don't want to leave
right.
them or
right.
compromise on them. So I'm
right.
happy to lose something small,
right.
It, you know, as long as it's not depriving from my entertainment.
Small, that's a key point.
Yeah.
You shouldn't hit them where it hurts.
Yeah, so with kids, that's the thing. With kids, they have certain things they're attached to.
Right.
That if they know that they will be deprived of, obviously it's going to, you know, trigger something in their heads.
Yeah.
So now we're talking about preventive measures, huh? Okay?
Right.
And so the child has not done anything. He has not committed anything. But we just tell them prior, and
yeah.
obviously nicely and gently, that if this happens, and obviously this is going to happen.
Right.
So, but I know you're a good boy; you'll never do it. But just in case.
Just in case.
Just in case.
Just for your information.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So just in case it happens. So this is also a way that we can use with our kids to make sure that we do not use violence.
Right.
Another thing that we also use with our kids, with instead of violence. When a kid does a mistake or he commits an act against the humanity, especially when he's
right.
2 years and more, you need to give him time and space for him to think and contemplate about his action.
Right.
So, for example, you know what? Some parents, they have timeout.
Yeah, right.
Like sit in the corner for a minute.
Yeah.
Go outside for a minute.
Right.
Go to your room for an hour or so.
Go to your room, right. Yeah.
Yeah, so this kind of limitation, I mean, no one likes, okay?
Captivity?
Yeah, captivity. But at the same time, the beauty of captivity is it makes you realize the mistake you made and what you've lost, which is your freedom.
Right, when you lose something you love and respect and
yeah.
you've taken for a given, you appreciate it a lot
yeah,
more when it's taken from you.
Exactly, and there's nothing more beloved to a person than his own freedom. When you see that it's been taken from you, then obviously you say, you know what, I'm not going to do this again just to make sure that I don't end up in this place again.
Of course. And with that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
Regarding the sixth verse of Surah At-Tahrim, the 66th Surah of the Holy Quran, that is, O you who have faith, save yourselves and your families from a fire. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, save your families from fire by enjoining them to do good and forbidding them from evil deeds.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how we can employ different manners of raising our children, all of them being non-violent. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Another way that we use with our children instead of violence is that we selectively ignore certain behaviors from the children.
Right.
The children themselves, if we pay attention to all their behaviors, not only they will get
mm-hmm.
harmed in the process, but me and you are going to get frustrated all the time.
Yeah.
So there are certain things that me and you, we just need to let it go. You know, well, kids are complaining all the time.
Right.
Kids always, you know, saying this happened. Or just, you know, being unhappy with certain things.
Right.
And a lot of people, when their kids start to nag, as we say, or complain or do these things,
and
they
whine,
get frustrated and angry themselves, and might result to
bad energy. So it rubs off.
So what we say is just ignore them. They're talking to you, for example, they're nagging and nagging. Just ignore them. You have to learn to ignore them.
Right.
So ignoring some of the bad behaviors, and when the child sees that there is not giving any results, it's not moving any forward,
right,
it's not working, they will give up themselves, right, and they will stop.
Being stubborn, for example, doesn't help.
Yeah.
Right? Or so just yelling and whatever it is doesn't help.
Exactly. So there's nothing happening. So he's like, you know what, might as well stop doing it.
Yeah.
So as parents, you need to have that ability to ignore.
Should be resilient.
What your children do, and, you know, take it easy, basically.
All
right. Having said that, that's as one of the ways for parents to avoid being angry. You could be more creative with kids. At least you can teach them a new skill. So occupy their time. When they have nothing to do, they will do bad. As we always say, if you don't have an aim, you will shoot aimlessly.
Right.
It might hit, it might fail. So you need to have an aim in mind. So when you give a child an aim, when you give him a purpose, when you give him, teach him a new skill, when you teach him a new way, it will occupy his time, it will lessen his stress, it will lessen his anxiety, it will lessen his anger, and so on and so forth. I've seen this especially with kids who love Legos.
Right.
The bigger the Lego that you give him to make, the more occupied he is.
Right.
I mean, he might get a bit agitated if you try to
mess with his
Legos and then take the wrong cubes at the wrong time.
Yeah.
But at least you give him a skill that he developed over time that, you know, he can engage in, and obviously keeping him busy. So the hadith from the Ahl Bayt Alayhim something from Amir al-Mu'minin says, Al-kasal mudharrun bid-deen wad-dunya. Laziness affects your dunya and your deen.
Right.
So basically, don't give him time to be lazy doing nothing, because this is the source of corruption.
Right.
So teach him a new trade, teach him a new skill.
Buy him a huge puzzle.
Buy him
for example.
Whatever you can do to teach him something new.
A clock.
If you can, why not?
Yeah.
Teach him karate, teach him kung
whatever
fu,
it is.
Teach him kickboxing. You can do a lot of things. Teach him something new.
Right.
Give him a new purpose. Give him a new idea. Put something in his head. So at least now he is channeled elsewhere.
Right.
So this is all, like we said, this is all preventive measures that we take in order to, for me and you, to avoid violence with our kids.
And on that note, we will unfortunately have to end today's program. I thank you for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any comments or questions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. In addition to that, we also have social media accounts on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.